morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Air Cascadia has a special feature today, an interview with Vandana Shiva.
Portland's East Side business leaders aren't sold on the Rose Quarter sports spectacle.
And a provision that would have restricted companies receiving federal government bailout money and from paying bonuses was quietly stripped from a bill just last month.
Portland area weather, mostly cloudy in the north, highs around 50. Tonight, overcast and wet, temperatures in the mid-30s to low 40s, and then tomorrow, more of the same.
First up, regional news from around Cascadia. Eastside business leaders are not enthused with the glorious Rose Quarter Baseball Stadium. The city's grand plan to build a sports complex may excite sports fans, but it's proving a tough sell to the Eastside District. One reason is that they weren't consulted on the complicated deal, even though it's going to take $18.5 million of their urban renewal money. Another reason is that a baseball stadium doesn't fit into the eight-year-old plan that the city had for the quarter.
Oregon has a good idea. Scrap steel into inexpensive housing. Here's the deal. Local scrap metal company Metro Metals Northwest takes junked cars, crushes them, then breaks them up in a massive chipper. The glass and plastic are also recycled. Rob Boydston of Miranda Homes says recycled steel is much more affordable than raw steel, which must be mined, usually at huge cost to the environment. What's not to like?
Exactly, Liam, because here we are with dwindling forests, logging companies still clamoring to be allowed to clear-cut more and more and more acres, even in national forests. And we have thousands upon thousands of cars piling up. Why not use the cars to build housing? Portland transportation planners are holding an open house today to discuss the new pedestrian bridge that will cross over Interstate 5 underneath the Portland Aerial Tram. Neighborhood activists in the Lair Hill area west of I-5 have long sought the Gibbs Street Pedestrian Bridge project. It's going to connect that area to the emerging South Waterfront area and the Willamette River.
Portland's bike registry plan is probably dead. A proposed bill requiring all bicycles on the road to be registered with a $54 licensing fee every 2 years is by all reasonable measures dead. Now prepare for a fierce debate on making the so-called Idaho stop legal for cyclists.
If a stagnant housing market is causing the likes of Boise Cascade to lay off workers another 30 just yesterday, why? Why? Is the timber industry still suing to protect its right to rape the earth? All you can do is keep fighting them in court. Yesterday, conservation groups added new endangered species claims to their lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's plans to boost logging in western Oregon.
In California, a Riverside County town is going green to combat foreclosure blight. A contractor has been hired to spray paint lawn bald spots in Paris. Contractor Dave Milligan uses an environmentally friendly dye that lasts up to 6 months and is harmless to people and pets. The city hopes the foreclosed properties are bought and occupied before the lawn needs a touch-up.
See, this is a good thing because it's environmentally safe paint that they're using to spray the lawns. And now we go to our feature today on Air Cascadia. Last month, the Organicology Conference brought together people from all across the nation and indeed across the world to talk, listen, and learn from one another and from the presenters. The featured speaker was physicist, seed activist, and ardent opponent of the crimes of globalization, Vandana Shiva. I'm speaking with Vandana Shiva at the Organicology Conference in Portland, Oregon, and I just have a few questions.
Well, until the 1980s, the Indian seed supply was in the hands of Indian farmers or public breeding institutions. 80% was the farmer's own seed. Under pressure of the World Bank and later under pressure of WTO, the Indian seed supply was opened up to global corporations. The first seed that was brought in to the country was hybrid sunflower by Cargill, and we were forced to allow it to enter through U.S. trade pressure, where the U.S. trade representative has said, crowbar by crowbar, we're going to open up your economy for our companies. And when the hybrid sunflower seed failed badly, farmers lost their crop, the farmers said, crowbar by crowbar, we will pack up your companies and send them back home. And they physically dismantled Cargill's plant in a major action, to which Cargill responded and said, the farmers are stupid because we bring seeds that prevent the bees from usurping the pollen, because in hybridization you don't allow open pollination through pollinators. You ensure that you do the physical breeding by hand in order to have hybrid vigor, but also in the process you lose the renewability of seed because the second generation does not breed true.
And you talked also, I was very moved by the parallel you drew between freedom and seed, and you have to have seeds. You have to be free to save seeds, you have to be free to plant seeds, and you have to be free to deal with what you grow, not just the yield.
Very quietly and very quickly, I think humanity is losing its freedom. Freedom to choose the food you will eat. But you cannot choose the food you will eat unless you have the freedom to save the seed, to grow the food you will eat. Increasingly, corporations are pushing GMOs that nobody wants. Every time a referendum is done anywhere in the world, people say no to genetically modified crops. But they are becoming a forced part of the human diet by taking over the seed supply and preventing farmers from having their own seed. That is why, for me, freedom is built into the seed. If we are free to save seeds, if we are free to grow seeds, we will be able to be free to have our food freedom, to choose the food we will eat and say no in a serious way to toxic food, to genetically engineered food.
And finally, my last question, what do you think it would take in America, in the West, to motivate farmers to overcome fear and really stand up to companies like Monsanto and Cargill?
I think the first thing is American people have shown that they can overcome fear. After all, they brought Obama to power on the basis of a huge popular mobilization. It isn't Obama who won. It's the people of America who made him win. And the same energy and the same confidence and the same fearlessness that was mobilized for one individual should surely be mobilized to make sure the farmers and the American public reclaim their freedom for food. And that has to be done by ensuring that farmers are able to say no to the Monsantos and the police states that they are creating in rural America, threatening farmers, suing farmers. I think if farmers across the board in the U.S. did what we do, a seed satyagraha, like Gandhi salt satyagraha, and said, we will not grow your seed, we will not obey your patent law, we do not want your genetically modified seed. But they can only say that if, meantime, there is an organic seed supply being built up. And the two have to go hand in hand. The positive constructive action of creating seed banks, community seed banks of open seeds, open pollinated seeds, and saying no to non-renewable seed, contaminated seed, genetically modified seed. It's totally doable. And like I said, if all of that energy could help Obama win, surely that energy can help Monsanto lose.
Thank you so much, listeners. Of course, this is Vandana Shiva speaking with me. You heard it. I will leave it. So let's go out and do it.
While the rest of the country gears up to repair failing infrastructure in public spaces and actually build things, what's Oregon doing with its stimulus money? We're cutting down more trees in the summer when the fire danger is highest, using huge sparking machinery. When President Obama encouraged governors to hurry up and begin building bridges and schools to revive the economy, he probably wasn't thinking Lincoln logs.
There are currently some 107 known government classifications that stand between we the people and how they make the sausage. Yesterday, the House voted to simplify the way the federal government handles information with the goal of making documents more available to the public. Ultimately, the legislation would maximize public access to government info. The legislation itself, however, is so complicated we weren't able to get it onto Air Cascadia too long.
A third Winter Soldier conference unfolded, this time overseas. In the lead-up to NATO's 60th summit next month in Strasbourg, Germany, Winter Soldier Europe took place in nearby Freiburg. Iraq and Afghanistan veterans from Germany, the UK, and the US testified, revealing the impact of the occupations on civilians and service members alike.
All across the world, people, all across the world. Well, this week has been the week that AIG and the American people will never forget. KBOO's Spencer Raymond joins us to talk about the AIG scandal, what it's doing to the Obama administration's image and its efforts to get the country back on track. There have been some very interesting twists and turns. Spencer, what do you make of it?
Hi, good morning, Chris. Yeah, you know, it's interesting when we talk about political capital here. I mean, that was really a term coined by George Bush back after he won re-election in 2004. How much political capital does the president have post-election to really do whatever they want, both from a policy standpoint and talking to the American people and convincing Congress to go along with them, which now isn't as big of a deal because, as we know, Congress is controlled, both houses are controlled by Democrats. But a lot of people are saying this week, especially after what we know now about AIG was made public, that Obama's political capital is basically spent. And, you know, think about all the money that he's spent with the bailouts, with helping out these banks that weren't very popular, necessary but not very popular when he did that. He used up his political capital. And now with these mistakes being made, look, government money was going to executive bonuses, was going to, you know, companies that were part of AIG that AIG just paid out. People are starting to question, are these bailouts, are these policies by the Obama White House really necessary? And now that he's into his presidency a few months, people are not going to take what he says as the gospel anymore, like they may have a month ago. They're going to start criticizing him more, like I said, because that political capital is waning.
And one of the things that came out just yesterday, this new revelation that there was a provision that would have in legislation that a month ago that would have restricted companies receiving federal bailout aid from paying bonuses. This legislation was stripped from a bill last month. The measure was introduced by Ron Wyden. It was removed by negotiators in a late-night closed-door meeting. Senators agreed to limit executive compensation but decided to forego barring excessive bonuses. This is just a month ago. This has just hit the fan this morning, and it's not going to help matters as far as selling the idea that we have to continue to prop up AIG.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, there's a lot of, and we've said this before, there's a lot of little intricacies in how these bailouts work. I mean, how do you give a company money to say, here, we're giving you this money so you can continue functioning, when an inherent part of a bank functioning is paying their executives six-figure salaries? I mean, that kind of goes with the territory if you're talking about banks and if you're talking about helping them. So how I mean, can the federal government give bailout money with strings attached, saying you have to use this for operations, but you can't use it for, you know, salaries? Will banks want it then, and how complicated? I mean, you know, then you get into this whole legal language, and it becomes much, much, much more complicated than it already is right now.
Well, they're talking about if they can't get the money back straight up, they're talking about taxing it out of them, and we'll see how that's probably a dream, but we'll see how that plays out. Spencer, thank you so much. And of course, was KBOO Spencer Raymond joining us, as he does every weekday morning with DC Dirt. Thanks so much for that, Spencer.
And in D.C., today, the Senate confirmation hearings for former Washington Governor Gary Locke got underway. He faced mostly friendly questions at the hearing for nomination as Commerce Secretary. He's Obama's third nominee for the Commerce post.
And finally, this. You know what it's like when you go to the airport and you've got to take off your shoes and hand over your toothpaste and everything? Pete DeFazio, Oregon's own congressman, had it up to the gills and told airport security what he thought about the rather excessive measures that they were taking. He was apparently singled out for special search, quite unnecessarily. Now, of course, Roll Call has seized upon the story and is running full tilt with it. Good luck, Roll Call.
This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Wednesday, March 18th, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. An Iraq veteran talks about why he went AWOL and now plans to march on the Pentagon, and more on the police killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland.
I say we levitate the Pentagon. The time is right. Thanks for listening and have a good day.
Today on Flashpoints, an Iraq veteran and leader of the anti-war movement tells Flashpoints why he went AWOL and why he's about to march on the Pentagon. Also, the cold-blooded murder of Oscar Grant, a new in-depth investigation into what happened January 1st, 2009. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to the police murder of Oscar Grant in Oakland on the 1st of this year. This from a breaking story in Revolution. Early New Year's morning, phones in Haywood and Oakland were ringing. Wake up, wake up. Something's happened to the boys. Calls were going back and forth between the families of 22-year-old Oscar Grant and his friends. Families so close, all the women were called aunties. The youth had gone to San Francisco to celebrate. Quote, what the hell had happened? One auntie exclaimed. After family and friends went to the hospital, the hellish heart tearing news soon came. Oscar, their lifelong friend, the only one, the one they had played baseball with, gone camping with, and swimming with, was dead. Shot in the back by BART police officer Johannes Mescherle. The police murder caught on cell phone videos has shocked people. In its wake, the police, the lawyers, the district attorney, the city of Oakland, BART, and the media have spun all kinds of explanations. The killer cop was a poorly trained rookie. He meant to go for his taser. He was scared. He's a lone racist. It was a terrible, unexplainable mistake. But the events of January 1st show that these explanations are lies designed to cover up the truth, and there is a real concern that with killer cop Johannes Mescherle and his preliminary hearing coming next Monday, March 23rd, that this could be buried and justice won't be done. With us to talk about a major new investigation into the police murder of Oscar Grant with new information and eyewitness accounts are Larry Everest and Rako Redmond. Everest and Redmond are two members of a Revolution newspaper coverage team here in the Bay Area. The article that we will talk about, plus new information since its publication, is called The Cold-Blooded Murder of Oscar Grant, What Happened the Morning of January 1st, 2009. It's based on extensive research, as we said, new interviews, including with people who, as we said, were eyewitnesses, two who were in the train car, also close friends and family members. Thank you both for joining us, and it is good to have you in the studio now. And let's begin this way. Reiko, Larry, you've laid this whole event out in a way that hasn't been done so sophisticated, in such a journalistically complete way. And we appreciate that. And you argue that the murder was the culmination of all that had come before that night. But now it's not speculation. It's not disparate details. You prove not an isolated event, not unexplainable. Let's talk about what happened. Let me start with you, Reiko. Just sort of give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened before the car pulled in, when the car pulled in, and then, Larry, you can pick it up from there. And we're talking about the BART car that was met by these killer cops.
Well, it was New Year's Eve, and the BART was packed with people coming back from San Francisco. And Oscar Grant and a large group of his friends were coming back. The police say that the train operator radioed that there was an incident going on, possibly a verbal argument on the train, and police were coming to deal with that incident. But everyone agrees that we've talked to that by the time the BART actually pulled into the Fruitvale station, the car was completely calm. As soon as it got to the station, Tony Peroni was there on the scene.
Now, that's one of the cops. And before we get into the cops, significant to your reporting and to the work that you're doing now, you have two eyewitnesses who came forward to talk about what happened inside the car and who say that there was no argument. They were there. There was no argument. So if there was no argument, then the call to bring the police forward is a false call, and then the murder was a setup by the police.
Well, a slight correction to that. There was an argument that went on, but what they remarked on was that it was an extremely minor incident and that it was over and done with long before the train came to Fruitvale.
Okay. I mean, and anybody that rides on BART, a packed train, these things happen all the time. And I think we have to add that these new witnesses that have come forward, they're not part of, they don't know Oscar Grant. They're not part of the extended friends and family. They had no connection whatsoever to this case. And spontaneously, without prompting, they told us, yeah, we were there. This was no big thing at all. We had no idea even what was going on. So these people are completely, you know, unbiased witnesses. And I think the other thing we have to point out is that no one has been charged in a fight. No victim of the fight has come forward. The train, to at least to date, the BART operator and no one from BART has said, yes, the train operator positively identified anyone on this train. And one can imagine that something happens, somebody turns on the phone and it goes up to the BART train operator and she has no idea and maybe perhaps, and again, a lot of this we're going to continue to investigate and tear apart, because even some of the official story that we're hearing from BART and the BART police and BART itself, you know, this is all suspect.
Now, and these two people who were on the train, how crowded did they say the train was?
They say the train was packed. Everybody, it was very, very crowded, and in fact, the so-called incident happened virtually under their nose.
And one other thing to point out here is, look, let's face it, Oscar and his friends made the quote-unquote responsible decision not to drink and drive. They took BART. They did as they're urged to do on the television. Take BART. Don't be out on the highways on January 1st. And look where that responsible decision got them.
Okay, now we're going to come back to this train full of witnesses that was hustled out of the station instead of surrounded with duct tape as a criminal crime scene. But so the train pulls in. What happens?
Well, immediately.
Based on, and explain to how we know exactly what happens.
Well, I mean, based on both the video, but also testimony from people close to this about what happened before the video, you know, three of Oscar's friends got off the train at Fruitvale. Three of the friends got off. They weren't stopped. But then Officer Peroni, who's ex-Marine and who was apparently up there, the first one up on the platform.
This is Tony Peroni, who was up there with Meshley.
That's right, and who we need to point out was never charged for anything in all of this, immediately singled out Oscar Grant and his friend Michael.
And Peroni, he could have been charged with a bunch of things besides just an accomplice to murder, if not...
felony murder.
Felony murder. But his brutality started before the killing.
Peroni saw Oscar's friends get off the train, and he immediately grabbed one of them. The only reason he could have grabbed them is they were black and Latino youth. He let Oscar's... partner, Sofina, go downstairs, and he grabbed her friend. Then he went in the train. He banged on the window. He pointed out to Oscar and Oscar's friend, Michael, that they had to get off. He went in and forcibly grabbed Michael by the dreadlocks, slammed him down on the concrete platform, and broke open a cut on his nose.
And, you know, this is witnessed by his friends who are saying, why are you doing this? What did we do? What's going on? And one of the things that the people on our Revolution team discovered was he went to a press conference that John Burris, who's the attorney representing the family in a civil lawsuit, and our reporter asked the question, well, what was being said on the platform that night? And Burris, and none of the Chronicle, Tribune, no, but none of the regular reporters are asking this. Burris said they were using the N-word and calling them MF and, you know, abusing them. So right now we see that the racial profiling and the racism and the national oppression directed at these young men who had done nothing, you know. Done nothing.
And in terms of Peroni slamming...
And this hasn't been reported. This has not been in the Chronicle, that headline, N-word used against Oscar Grant and friends. Not in there. Not there, Dennis.
It's certainly been in the San Francisco Bayview, which has been doing a great
job
with JR,
yes.
Who is facing charges, we might add, for trying to cover the aftermath,
right,
and the extraordinary response to this kind of murder. But getting police murder, but getting back to the scene, so how do we know the head was slammed by who? Who did the head slamming? How do we know that? Because that's a felony, and it's maybe attempted murder.
Well, it's been told to me by people very close to the case that this is what happened, that he first slammed his head on the ground. Oh, also, we know because the federal lawsuit lays out the course of events.
But this is Tony Peroni, the other cop, whacking...
Michael,
Oscar's friend.
Right.
He gets into the violence first.
Exactly.
And so, to in detail, explain what happened on that scene, because, as you say, it's context for the murder that comes later.
Okay, well, one thing is that when this begins to happen and when Oscar and his friends are, you know, pulled and made to sit down on the concrete after Michael is slammed down on the ground and handcuffed, other friends get off the BART to see what's happening. And the third officer, there were seven in all, the third officer, Marisol Domenici, comes up and sticks her taser in these three other youth's faces. And she actually... pokes it between the eyes of one of the youth, threatening him with a taser. And these are also youth who have done nothing to provoke this, except to say, "Why are you hurting him? What's going on?"
And then what happens?
Well, but this is where if people have seen the videos, and by the way, at this tribunal we're going to do,
we're going to tell people there's a tribunal on Saturday.
Sunday the 22nd, 2 o'clock, Calvin Simmons. Right. But the point is, people have seen little bits of this video. We're going to show all the videos and walk people through this very carefully, because by this time people have seen four or five young black men being pushed up against a cement wall in BART. Before all of this has even happened, there's been a very hard punch to Oscar's head. There's been smashing Michael's head down. There have been tasers being waved. And remember, all of this is illegal detention. There are no charges that have been filed here. There's no reading of rights. There's no real procedure. There's just this
police violence.
And, you know, Pironi and Mescherle, after this whole sequence of violence, not just by Mescherle, but by all the police on the platform there in one form or another, they are surrounding Michael. They're straddling Michael. They've got him flat on his stomach. His arms are behind his back. And Mescherle, you know, and there's more detail here, but I'm getting to the gist of the thing. And Mescherle tells Pironi, step back. Well, that tells us right there that this is, he is acting consciously. He's not lost his mind. He's not, you know, having a heart, whatever excuse it is. And he pulls out his gun and shoots him in the back.
Shoots Oscar
in the back. And in a certain way, and one thing, and I know, you know, one thing that the first excuse we get is the taser issue, but the taser weighs less than one quarter of the kind of gun that he
had. He didn't accidentally pull out his taser, and oh my God, I meant to taser you, and I shot you in the back.
No, opposite
side.
All right,
so they shot him in the back, cold blood. Lots of cops there, a train car full of witnesses, right? Crime scene. What happened? Did they rush to give medical care?
No, they didn't rush to care for him. In fact, you can see in the video that they actually flip him over and shake him a couple times.
After they shot him and he's bleeding out.
Yeah, and then they appear to handcuff him and then lead him to bleed out on the pavement. Meanwhile, the other cop is going after the people who have their cell phones and their video cameras out, and she's trying to grab at them. I do actually think that they confiscated a number of them. One of the witnesses, Karina Vargas, the first one who came forward with a video, actually had to run back on train to prevent this woman from taking her video, and that was the first one that was aired and that broke the story of what really happened.
So, again, and this train, I'm sorry I'm fixating on this, but this train full of witnesses, did the police start to question them in terms of what they saw? What happened to that train full of witnesses at the crime scene?
My information is that the police, perhaps Pironi, ordered the train operator to leave immediately. And you can see in the videos the horrified people on the train and the doors quickly closing and taking the whole train full of people back out of the station. And in fact, no superiors at BART knew that this shooting had occurred until one kid was showing his video at the end of the line. And that's how they found out. None of the police reported that they had shot somebody.
Right. They didn't call in a report, which, you know, would have brought the ambulances, would have brought the sort of attention to the fact that this was going on. And look, and people close to this have told us that the police told people who were yelling, and you hear this in the video, but also the people on the ground were yelling, help him, help him. And they told them to shut up or they wouldn't call an ambulance. That's what their response was. So, again, it shows this wasn't that, oh, my God, we made a huge mistake. How could we have done this? We had better save this person right now. No. No concern for him and covering up their tracks, protecting them, sending the train away.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
On Saturday, March 21st, veteran service members and their families will join with thousands of students and other young people, members of the Arab and Muslim community, anti-war and social justice organizers, labor unionists, and others from across the country in a series of major national marches happening in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco, and around the country. One of the organizers for the Washington, D.C. march this Saturday is James Cercello. He is a former veteran in the United States Army, airborne infantryman from the days of the first attacks in 2001 on Iraq. James Cercello, welcome to Flashpoints. Maybe you could begin by your own experiences as a soldier on the ground in Iraq. What did you see the impact of the American attack and occupation?
First, thanks for having me. You know, I joined the military right after 9/11 with this vision that it was a freedom-spreading institution. I had grown up watching these films, hearing stories from my family, you know, and military families, servicemen and women are turning to heroes. But when I went to Iraq, you know, it was completely devastating for me to see exactly what the U.S. Army, the U.S. government had actually been doing to the Iraqi people, you know, for countless decades through sanctions and bombings. And, it really devastated me, and that's why I'm here today as this anti-war activist organizer.
Are there faces, situations, moments from that war and occupation in Iraq that stand out in your mind that, say, haunt you to this day?
Yeah, there are a lot of things. Some that I've participated in, some that I just saw. A lot of what I still remember is my unit, we lived in the neighborhoods. We didn't live on bases. We lived in the working class Iraqi neighborhoods. And just to see the devastation, like I said, you know, there's open sewage water in the streets, children playing in it, you know, 10-year-old children playing in no shoes, running through sewage, not because Iraq can't afford and can't maintain a sewage system, but because the United States in the 90s bombed those things, the sewage treatment facilities, the electrical grids, all of these things, and you know, and that the sanctions that they weren't allowed to rebuild. So just seeing those things, it kind of completely turned my my perspective, my orientation, and those things haunt me.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with James Cercello. He is an organizer of one of a series of major marches happening on Saturday to protest the continuing, and we should say, expanding wars, if we include Afghanistan as a part of U.S. occupation plans. Let's talk a little bit about Obama. He ran on a peace platform. The peace movement gave him full and total and thorough support. I assume you voted for him. What's your take? You think he's going in the right direction?
Well, for the record, I didn't vote for him. I think he's going in the same direction that the United States government has always gone, and that is war makes profits for these CEOs, these defense contractors, for even the politicians that have invested in these banks and companies. And so he's continuing that route.
Afghanistan,
you know, bombing Pakistan. You know, the people there are really getting fed up. They're starting to, starting to speak out against it, sending in these drones to bomb villages, weddings, funeral parties, all of these things. And, you know, I mean, the Afghanistan war, it's just another deception. The people believe still, for some reason, that it's a good war. And that's, you know, his term, that we're fighting terrorists, that we're fighting Al-Qaeda. But, you know, the people of Afghanistan, we have to remember, they didn't attack the United States. there were no Afghans on the planes September 11th. No Afghan-backed group assaulted the United States in any form. So, during the candidate Obama spoke loudly against the wars in Iraq, but at the same time mentioned that he would increase the size of the military, increase the attacks in Afghanistan, and we're seeing that.
Now, you mentioned corporations making money hand over fist, if you will, on these wars of occupation and aggression. And I understand that the march that you're working on for Washington, D.C. this Saturday will, in fact, make stops at Boeing, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and KBR. You want to talk a little bit more about what these corporations are doing on the ground and perhaps how they are working to, if you will, support more war, expanded wars?
Yeah, we did some research into the CEOs of those four corporations. Those are just four of many that exist in the military-industrial complex, that term. It's not extreme to whenever you realize that their offices are just blocks away from the Pentagon. So, we're going over there. We're going to be delivering coffins to the CEOs and their offices, draped in flags from eight different countries and many others that people will bring. Of victims, of the multinational victims of U.S. imperialism, corporate greed, and just the militarist attitude and aggression of the United States. So we're going to bring those coffins in a symbolic gesture to tell them, you make tanks, you make bombs, you love war, but what you really make are these coffins, these dead people. And so we expect that to be, a great action. And hope, people will participate, be willing to carry the coffins. A little about those CEOs, they've all gone on record saying 2007, 2008, those were record year for profits. Those are great years, and they expected the next years to be even better. They're all Lockheed Martin. They're involved in several contracts right now that they just got. At the same time, the United States is bailing out bankers and corporations with trillions of dollars going to these people. And at the same time, 10,000 people a day are being forced from their homes, being foreclosed, 20,000 a day being laid off. Students are facing tuition hikes. There's the police brutality is through the roof from the Oscar Grant all the way to Baltimore, where we just had a shooting. At the same time, I'm from Baton Rouge, right, and lived between Baton Rouge and New Orleans still isn't rebuilt. The people are still suffering, the working class is suffering, and Obama and the United States government are funding the bankers. They're giving taxpayer money to the bankers and letting us suffer. So that's what it's about. It's not just an anti-war action. It's an action and a demonstration against racism and against these bailouts. And, all of these things.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with James Circello. He's a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom and an organizer of the March 21st March. This is the march on Pentagon, on the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and will be also doing an interview on the planned organization march and rally in San Francisco. But I did want to ask you, James, in terms of the veterans, the way they're treated, talk a little bit about the fight to get care for so many wounded who probably would have died in other wars, but because of the advanced technology, you can keep these guys and women alive, but it's a horrifying aftermath.
Yeah, it's very troubling. President Obama just spoke yesterday at the Department of Veterans Affairs here in D.C. and talked, committing himself to taking care of veterans, taking care of soldiers that come back from the war. And, it's great to hear that. It's another thing to do it. The VA is terribly underfunded, understaffed. The bureaucracy within the VA, it's immense, and it's difficult to get anything done. You know, like you said, it's a lot easier with the modern day technology to keep people alive, and that's why we've only seen 4,600 U.S. soldiers die. But we don't hear about the over 100,000 soldiers that are wounded. Almost nearly all of the 2 million soldiers that have gone cycled through Afghanistan and Iraq suffer from some kind of brain trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other things. At the same time, President Obama promised to combat veterans' homelessness issues. You know, any given night, there are 200,000 veterans that are homeless. And during 1 year's time, 400,000 veterans will have been homeless at least at one point during the year. So, you know, I applaud him for taking the initiative and talking about it, but, you know, I want to see him do something about it, just like the rest of America wants to see him do something about it.
What role are military families playing in the growing resistance to the war and the expanding war in Afghanistan? Are there more military families willing to open up to the information?
I think they play a great role. You know, they have a story that a lot of people in America don't have. They've lost a family or a family member, a loved one, in a war that, you know, sometimes they didn't believe was illegal. They believed in the war, and then losing that loved one turned them into opposing the war. So, I mean, I believe they have a huge role to play in the anti-war movement and a great voice. We're expecting a large group of military families to be at the D.C. demonstration as well as the San Francisco and L.A. demonstrations, you know, marching at the front of the march, you know, veterans, active duty, military families, and Arab Muslim Americans, a huge contingent. All these people marching side by side to show our solidarity and support for one another.
Well, I want to find out as we conclude this interview, I want to find out just a little bit more about what's at the heart of the matter for you, James. In April of 2007, your unit was preparing to deploy to Afghanistan, and you, I guess they say, deserted the military. A month later, you issued an open letter to the U.S. government declaring that you were officially resigning from the military. While you were AWOL, you did speeches, you spoke around the country. Talk about what it meant for you to say no at that point, what you learned from that decision, and what's at the core in that context.
It was a tough decision to make. I had been considering it for years, honestly. Even prior to the invasion of Iraq, I was on the phone with my mother many times, and I wanted to leave. And unfortunately, it took me nearly 4 years later to leave. You know, a lot of soldiers, and I was stationed in Italy, so I really was far removed from the media. We don't get the information that's put out there. We just get what our commanders tell us and our senior enlisted soldiers tell us. And so when I went AWOL, it was a very difficult time. I made the decision after I had come to the conclusion that the Democrats, they had ran for Congress on the anti-war platform as well and said that they were going to not fund the war. They were going to cut off funds. So I gave them a few months. Well, April 2007 rolled around, and I noticed that they weren't going to end the war. So I said I was going to, you know, do it myself. I was against the Afghanistan war. I refused to participate in it. So I went AWOL and began speaking out. And, you know, I received great support. I think that what made it possible for me to exist as an AWOL soldier in the anti-war community and not go to jail was just my voice. And I felt that I had a message that people needed to hear, that a message that the news wasn't reporting, either because they didn't have the actual truth or that they chose not to report it. So I felt I had a message that I was, you know, I was obligated to tell people exactly what was going on. And at the same time, being so loud as a AWOL soldier, it allowed me to, they didn't come after me. The military didn't want to come after me for fear of making it a bigger issue within the media and whatnot.
And in the final 30 seconds, your advice to young men and women just about to walk into that recruiter's office and serve their country and answer the call as patriots, your advice?
My advice is to know exactly what you're getting into, that the U.S. military is not a place to go for job training. I got little to no job training, nothing to put on my resume. It's not a place for college education money. I have no college education money. For females, one out of three females, the moment they knock on the recruiter's door, will be raped, assaulted in a sexual manner, or gang raped. This is Department of Army and Defense stats. The military is a highly racist organization, institutionalized racism. So people of color, Latinos, Hispanics, African Americans, will all witness some sort of racist act. So to really look at what you're getting into before you go, and, you know, get in touch with Answer Coalition, and I can talk to people more about that as well.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking more about that and the action in Washington, D.C. that you helped to organize and a major protest planned for the Bay Area as well as in Los Angeles to oppose the what appears to be the endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. James Cercello, thank you for your courage and your willingness to take on the Pentagon and the U.S. military and speak your truth to the powers that be. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
And we continue our coverage of protests being planned around the country by ANSWER and other coalitions to resist 6 years of war and apparently an expanded war in Afghanistan. Joining us now to continue the discussion and focus on what's happening in the Bay Area is Richard Becker of the ANSWER Coalition in the Bay Area. ANSWER, act now to stop war and end racism. Well, Richard, we just spoke with organizers from Washington, D.C., major protest planned this weekend for Washington, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. The Flashpoints team and KPFA will be broadcasting live starting at 1 o'clock from the Bay Area operation and action. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's planned for Saturday in the Bay Area?
Sure. Well, as I think James, who's with the Veterans and Active Duty Task Service Members Task Force of ANSWER, was pointing out as well, this is very, very important. Very, very important that people come out this weekend and join in the demonstrations that are taking place around the country. Here in the Bay Area, there's a quite wide-ranging coalition that has come together. The Alameda and San Francisco Central Labor Councils are participating. There's going to be a large labor contingent that's going to be participating in the demonstration. We're going to be marching from the Justin Herman Plaza up to the Civic Center and starting at 11 o'clock on this coming Saturday, March 21st. I think it's really important for people to know that contrary to the sense that things are now winding down, which is even unfortunately being said in some progressive circles, there is nothing really winding down. There's a shift in the patterns in the war in Iraq, but the fact remains that in Iraq, 5 million people are displaced inside the country, and there is no real affirmation or promise. Even if you listen, if you read carefully President Obama's remarks about this when he was at Camp Lejeune and made this speech, which was quite a very triumphalist speech about how the job has been done and so forth. I think it was a surprise to many people to hear that. But he said that they intend to have all the combat troops out by August in 2010 and all the remaining troops out by the end of 2011, except for the fact that they have built the largest embassy in the world. And they're talking, in fact, after the supposed removal of the combat troops in August 2010, that the forces that remain there will be to train and to carry out operations against al-Qaeda. Well, does that mean that they are non-combat troops are going to be carrying out those operations? I don't think so. I mean, it sounds like a little bit of the way Vietnam unfolded in reverse, you know, with the so-called advisors that were there and were really participating in combat for years before. But there's no promise of that. There's a promise that there could be up to 30,000 more troops going into Afghanistan, and the siege of the Palestinian people has not relented one bit, and this was tragically brought home, I think, you know, with the terrible wounds that Tristan Anderson and many others have suffered in just in recent days trying to prevent the building of the apartheid wall in the West Bank. The siege of Gaza has not ended. The pumping of money into the military budget is at a record level, and it's going to be increased. The real Pentagon budget this year, if you put together all the different aspects that are hidden in different parts of the federal budget, will amount to $1.3 trillion at a time when millions of people are losing their homes and losing their jobs. So the need to march, the need to demonstrate, the need to be out on the streets, it really has never been greater.
We're speaking with Richard Becker of the Answer Coalition in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. will be the site of major protests this weekend on Saturday. We'll be broadcasting from Civic Center, where the march will end up starting at 1 o'clock. We're looking forward to that. Richard, you mentioned Palestine, and we are all troubled by the continuing shootings. The shooting of Tristan Anderson was followed by Israeli shooting three Palestinians, I think, yesterday. Snipers were shooting people even as Tristan Anderson was taken away to the hospital. And we know in the savaging of Gaza, major U.S. military corporations once again made a lot of money. For instance, Boeing producing those vicious, destructive dime bombs that shred the body from the inside out. So talk a little bit about the relationship between the corporations as a corporate war.
Well, it certainly is a corporate war, and I just to make another connection there, we're going to be marching up Market Street. We're going to be going by AIG. We're going to be going by Citibank and Wells Fargo and Bank of America. These banks also share in those profits. We don't have the military contractors right on the scene on Market Street in San Francisco, like where they're marching, or who they're going to be confronting in Virginia next to the Pentagon, though, where they have their headquarters, conveniently very close to the Pentagon. But the banks, the big banks, share in this as well, and in many cases make even more from the wars. And the relationship between the U.S. military and the Israeli military, really from the Pentagon's point of view, the Israeli military is an extension of U.S. military power. There's no question about that. The reason that all these hundreds of billions of dollars in military aid have flowed in, the reason that they had an emergency shipment in the midst of the Israeli offensive, an expedited shipment of more weaponry so that the Israeli forces that were using just about every weapon short of nuclear bombs on the people in Gaza so that they could continue to do that, illustrates the relationship that exists, this intimate relationship between the U.S. military and the Israeli military. And the U.S. military, the Israeli military carries out tests that the U.S. government, the U.S. ruling interests want to see carried out, such as the assault on Lebanon, the assault on the Palestinians. They want to crush all resistance to their rule, to U.S. domination in the Middle East. And that relationship has to be brought out and will be brought out this Saturday at the marches.
Well, people listening in these different cities, Washington, Los Angeles, here in the Bay Area, how can they participate? Can they play a role beyond protesting? Can they join the organizing crews? How can they be a part of this if they'd like?
Well, we have 4 days left. People can go to our website, AnswerSF, like Answer San Francisco, but just the initials, AnswerSF.org. You can download your own posters and flyers. You can distribute those. You can talk to your friends, neighbors, co-workers, fellow students. Bring them, get them to come to the demonstration, too. The two main themes of it are occupation is a crime, Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, and everywhere, and fund jobs, housing, health care, schools, not war and bank bailouts. So these are issues that I think are affecting the great majority of the population, and it's not going to change until people take action. Also, we need volunteers that day. We need people to be monitors. We need people to help with setup and takedown and distributing literature. Please call the answer office at 415-821-6545. It's 821-6545. And volunteer, we need your help. We need your help now.
All right, Dick Becker of the Answer Coalition, act now to stop war and end racism. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints. We'll see you on Saturday. As I said, we'll be broadcasting starting at 1 o'clock from Civic Center. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks very much, Dennis, and thanks to Flashpoint.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
This is Pat McGuire. I'm the host of Boneheads and Bigots. Join us on KBOO at our new time. We're on the third Friday of every month at 11 o'clock a.m. And you know Boneheads and Bigots. We talk about politics. We talk about anti-democratic elements in politics. We talk about public affairs. We talk about books. And we always talk about music. So join us at our new time. That means in March, we're going to be on Friday, March 20th at 11 o'clock a.m.
Good morning. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, your community radio station. Up next, The Food Show.
Good morning and welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm Miriam Widman, and normally we have with us Marlies Franklin today. Unfortunately, she's out with a sick kid, but we do have a new person on our show.
Hi, I'm Laura McCandless. I'm recently moved to Corvallis from Baltimore, and I'm pursuing food writing from there, so came up for the show today.
Okay, we have a jam-packed show for you today, and we're going to be talking today, of all things, about potatoes, which is, I guess, a good thing, because yesterday was St. Patrick's Day, and lots of people who celebrate St. Patrick's Day eat potatoes. So let's give you an idea about where we're going with this, and you're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM. Laura, tell us about what's going on.
90.7 FM, and also in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, and in Hood River at 90.1 FM, or you can live stream us online at KBOO FM. Let's see. Well, we just think that people are turning to potatoes more now, you know, in these tight economic times. Potatoes sustained our grandparents and parents during the Depression. And they're actually Oregon's seventh biggest cash crop, grown in the rural east, primarily for frozen French fry sales and chips in the Columbia Basin and for fresh sales in the Klamath Basin. So in the past, Bryant Terry, the author who's here to talk with us today, will let us know. In the past, potatoes have been maligned by the low-carb craze, but they really pack a nutritional, vitamin-rich punch.
Okay, and speaking of Bryant Terry, we'll have him. He's an eco chef who will tempt us with a recipe from cumin cayenne mashed potatoes with caramelized onions from his just-released cookbook, Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. We'll also have
heirloom potato breeder extraordinaire Tom Wagner of Tater Mater Seeds in Everett, Washington.
And local organic farmer Lyle Stanley of G Creek Farm. He'll be talking about potato varieties and how to plant them.
And our community segment will feature Roosevelt High School students learning to overcome learning disabilities by working together in the garden.
But first up is Bryant Terry. Take it away, Laura.
Okay. Bryant Terry, just in from Oakland this morning. He's a food justice advocate, an eco-chef, and cookbook author. He will be speaking and demonstrating recipes from his new book at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland tonight. Sorry, though, the Slow Food Portland event is sold out. But the first caller after the interview to call in will win a copy of Vegan Soul Kitchen, Bryant's new book. And the number that you're going to want to call when we give the signal is 503-231-8032. So, Bryant, this is also your second cookbook, I understand, or your second book. You also previously published Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen with Anna Lepe. But before we, so welcome, Bryant.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad to be here in Portland again.
Great. Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. I know you're probably on a busy publicity tour with the book. I saw you're going to be in Seattle at an eco festival later.
I'm all over the place. The book came out March 2nd, and I've been doing a lot of press, a lot of traveling, but I'm trying to hold off into the warmer months before I go to the Northeast and the Midwest.
So you're focusing on our region. Well, I'm glad we had a nice day for you today in Portland.
Beautiful.
It seems like the title of your book is really what's generating the most attention, because vegan and soul food, Vegan Soul Kitchen, just kind of causes people to do a double take. Why vegan soul food?
Well, the funny thing is that initially I actually did not want vegan in the title of the book, although I was a vegan for many years and continue to support the ideas of veganism and hold many of the ethics that veganism, the vegan philosophy and the diet. But for me, this book is really about reclaiming this legacy of African-American cuisine that's rooted in food that's as local as a backyard garden, as fresh as being harvested right before the meal, and as seasonal as whatever is being, whatever's in season. And it was important for me to create a cookbook that made an intervention in this cookbook genre that's oversaturated books with books that include animal products, you know. And as far as I know, there aren't any vegetarian or vegan African-American cuisine or soul food cookbooks that are published by a major publisher. Some great independently published ones that I've seen. So I really wanted to put this out and, you know, really provide an option for people who wanted to have animal-free food rooted in African-American cuisine. And as I say in the introduction, this book is for everyone. Whether you're a vegetarian, vegan, omnivore, you know, feel free to add, omit, substitute, you know, make these recipes yours. When I hand them over to you, then I invite people to have fun with them.
To freestyle, you said. So it's okay to even add some meat sustainably raised if we wanted to?
Well, I always say that it's not my place or anyone else's to determine what diet anyone should have. You know, diet is a very personal journey, and, you know, my continuum of consumption, as I say, I started off being an omnivore, you know, eating lots of good, fresh, local food in Memphis, Tennessee that my grandparents grew in their own backyard garden, and my parents grew in their backyard gardens. But then in high school, I was a vegetarian, and then a vegan, and then one summer in college, I was a fruitarian. And then I think I tried...
What's a fruitarian?
You know, just all fruits and live juices. I think I was a breatharian for a day. You know, I was a raw foodist. Went back to veganism in grad school. So for my own,
what are you now?
Right now, for political reasons, I choose not to give my diet a title. You know,
good
I think
for you.
When I think back about the way that I used to flaunt my diet, I'm a vegan and I'm a raw foodist. You know, I realized that I was doing it for other people, and I have. You know, if I were to characterize my diet, I would say that it's a plant-centered diet devoid of meat. But, you know, that sounds so utilitarian and it just dry. You know, I like good food. I like real food. The food that I eat is grown in my front yard garden that I have in my home in Oakland. We get the food that we get from our CSA, from local farmers markets. So I like eating real good food, and that's what I'm trying to push more people towards and away from what Michael Pollan calls edible food-like substances.
I'm curious, this is Miriam, where did you learn to cook?
I learned, you know what, although I went to culinary school at the Natural Gourmet Institute for Cooking and Health in New York City, I always say that I learned everything I know in my grandmother's kitchen. My maternal grandmother was a brilliant cook, and also, you know, cooking with my paternal grandfather. And so I grew up in a family that valued good food. You know, my both sets of my grandfathers came from rural Mississippi, migrated to Memphis in their teens, and maintained that agrarian knowledge and connection to the earth and a respect for the land and growing our own food in our family. And, you know, I like to say that we had a mini CSA back then, because we would have so much surplus that we would not only have enough for the family, we would give it away to neighbors, barter with neighbors, give it away to church members. And so, you know, everything that I'm doing goes back to my foundation in Memphis, Tennessee, growing good food, eating good food, and learning about the ethics of sharing and, you know, building community around food.
And just to add to that, you wrote in the intro to your book that you could have just as easily called it Citrus Collards with Raisins, Recipes as Autobiography. So, what is the purpose of this book, and how much of it is a cookbook versus a autobiography? How did your history and your people's history inspire the book?
Well, my work draws heavily from history and memory, and it's highly influenced by one of my heroines, the late Edna Lewis, who was a chef who grew up in Freetown, Virginia in the South, moved to New York City in the 40s and the 50s, and really popularized Southern cuisine in the Southeast. In the Northeast United States. And, you know, the work that she was doing, I think, predates a lot of the work that one of my mentors and friends, Alice Waters, was doing in terms of popularizing and really putting a focus on fresh, seasonal, good food. And she always says that she wanted to share the good flavors and delicious foods that she grew up eating in the South. And that's part of my mission. And so, you know, I think it's important for me to tell the stories and talk about the history of growing and eating and harvesting, you know, all these ways that I connected to food, because I think there's so many people in the United States, if you talk to them, their grandparents grew their own food, you know, and their great-grandparents had their own gardens. And like most Americans, African Americans kind of saw the industrialization and mechanization of our food system and the globalization of agriculture as a good thing. You know, it was cheap, it was fast, it was convenient. But 40 years later, we see the fallout on that. And so, you know, for me, it's just like, okay, we got on the industrial treadmill, it didn't work. Let's get back to what we know works for the earth, for local economies, for our health, and for our communities.
This is Miriam again, and I'll let you know if you just turned in, you're listening to the KBOO Food Show, and we have as our guest Brian Terry, who's a food author, and we will be opening up the phone lines for callers' questions. Keep the number in mind, 503-231-8187, and he has written a book, Vegan Soul Kitchen. Sorry, he has written a book, Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. And my understanding is that we'll have a copy of that book Laura, can
after the interview, we will the first caller to call in to the front desk. We'll give that number after the interview. We'll win a copy.
An autographed copy.
An autographed copy. Mm-hmm. He's throwing in an autograph. Okay. So, yeah, even though the event tonight is sold out, we wanted everyone to be able to get a little piece of Brian Terry. Let's see.
Well, if I can stop in with one question. You know, it's interesting that you talked a lot about the South and about, you know, growing things and, you know, traditions. I think generally when people look at Southern cuisine, they think of Greece as being a major food group from Southern cuisine. That cuisine, I think, has been maligned by many people, or people think that it's just stuff kind of sitting in pans of oil or whatever. I mean, is that a misrepresentation of what goes on in Southern cooking? Is that changing, or is that, I don't know, just a stereotype?
I think it is a misrepresentation that, you know, in the popular imagination, African American cuisine, soul food, Southern cooking is the deep fried fatty meats, the sugary desserts, you know, and that's certainly a part of it. But as I always say, when I grew up eating this food, those were the type of foods that we ate on holidays, on special occasions, you know, on celebrations. But the food that we were eating every day was as local as our backyard garden. You know, we would go out there, we would harvest it. I would be in the kitchen preparing it with my grandparents. They were raising their own chickens. Most of the time when we had chickens from their backyard, they would bake them. You know, the greens that we had would often be cooked for a long time, but sometimes they would quickly saute them. So I think that what I want people to understand is African American cuisine, Southern cooking, soul food, if you will, is much more rich, complex, and diverse than it's been kind of like presented. And, you know, we can go into the history about how in the 1960s, it was kind of reclaimed, but then the white media picked up on it and they were focusing on these more exotic aspects. And I think, you know, it's just time for us to kind of like talk about what it really is. It's not just the comfort foods as I like to see it.
Well, I'm getting hungry. Let's get to the cookbook. And we would like you to specifically talk about some of your potato recipes, since that's our theme of the show. And wouldn't you agree there are food people turn to more in tight economic times because they pack so much sustenance in? First of all, just tell us how this cookbook is arranged. It's not your typical cookbook, and there are music, film, and book selections to go along with each recipe.
Yeah, you know, since I started doing this work, well, you know, the origins of my kind of activism in this work actually came about when I was in high school and I heard this hip-hop song by this rapper KRS-One when he was talking about factory farming, and just, you know, that led me to Upton Sinclair's A Jungle. And so the kind of like impetus for my own activism was rooted in music and literature and art, and these are things that I like to weave in. You know, I think one of my biggest issues with, you know, having been an activist for the past 8 years, an advocate around these issues, is that oftentimes in the organizing and the advocacy, what gets lost is the food and the celebration. What we're all working for is a food system in which everyone has access to good, delicious food. And so I want to bring that back to the center of this movement for food security or food justice. And I think it's also important to bring back this, you know, community building and celebration. So with each recipe, I have a suggested soundtrack. You know, sometimes I have books and film recommendations, and I really want to present people with just the way that I connect with food. You know, when I have people over, we're eating good food, we're listening to music, and it's just all about bringing those things together.
Thanks. It looks like we have a caller. LJ, welcome to the KBOO Food Show.
Well, hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine.
Yeah, great.
Okay, great. Just a shout out to Michelle Obama, who is now buying locally grown produce for the White House.
Yeah, shout out to Michelle Obama.
Yeah, she made a profound statement saying that fresh, homegrown, and locally grown vegetables are delicious. So maybe, just maybe, people will start to see that now that Michelle Obama is on it, and people will start to buy from local farmers and grow their own. And thank you so much for the show. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Any comment on that, Brian, or what the Obamas could do for nutrition and
Well, I think they could do a lot. I think it would be a profound statement for them to actually plant a garden on the White House lawn. But I think something that the caller said, you know, about the food being delicious, for me, that has been one of the major pull factors and things of recruiting people into what Alice Waters calls this delicious revolution. You know, food that is locally grown, it's going to have so much more flavor. You know, I have family members who live in the South who grew up eating this food that was, you know, local and delicious, but then kind of got on that industrial treadmill and are eating canned goods and, you know, food that's been shipped across the country or sitting in a grocery store for a couple of weeks. And I bring fruit home from the farmer's market in the Bay Area to them, and they're like, you know, this is so good. I haven't had a peach like this in years. And it's because they've, you know, gotten away from the good food. And I use delicious food, you know, I say more than writing books or doing workshops or writing articles, the way that I've helped more people shift their relationship with food or think about eating more healthfully or, you know, thinking about being more active around these issues is making them a delicious meal. Mm. And guess what? You know, if you have this food that's local, that's sustainable, it's going to be delicious and it's going to improve your health if you eat it in copious amounts. It's going to be good for local economies. It's great for the environment. So, you know, those are all the benefits. But I think a lot of times when you start with the heady intellectual stuff, it can shut people down. So I start with the, you know, the visceral, just good stuff, the food.
Path of least resistance, yeah.
I just want to remind callers, we have just a few more minutes with Brian Terry. If you're interested in your vegan soul food questions or anything else, 503-231-8187. Laura?
Let's just continue to walk through the cookbook a little bit more. I noticed I was going to ask you what your favorite recipes were in the book, but then I noticed you preempted that question by having a section called the top six good eats, because you said you always get that question. And I'm sure each one of these is your baby, but how did you pick the recipes in the top six good eats?
You know, these were just the recipes that I found myself coming back to because they were delicious. And, you know, I always say the litmus test for the recipes in this book wasn't if they would go well with my community in the Bay Area or you know, friends in the community in New York City, but could these recipes pass the test of my parents and other family members living in the Deep South? Mm-hmm. And if they didn't, they got cut from the book, you know, because I don't care how much something is quote unquote healthy. For me, I don't want it unless it's delicious. And I know that most people, if they're going to think about eating more sustainably and healthfully, the food has to be good. And so recipes like my, you know, my kind of signature dish, the citrus collards with raisins, I wouldn't have, you know, I was really nervous about a lot of older African Americans and older Southerners in general, how they would respond to it. But people have been really excited about it and they like it. And it's different than what a lot of them have traditionally eaten or the way that they've traditionally eaten greens. But, you know, I think when the food's good, when it's fresh, you know, people are open to it. And so, but my favorite, I'll say my favorite recipe at this moment is black-eyed pea fritters with hot pepper sauce. You know, that's
one. Oh, wow. I never would have come up with that one.
I like to call that a gateway recipe for people who might be hesitant to eat food that is devoid of animal products. You know, it's just like really good, crunchy, creamy on the inside, and that hot pepper sauce, let me tell you, it's really good.
Did you eat that growing up?
That recipe?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. But, you know, the thing
where
is...
Where did it come from?
Well, so the thing is, with this book, what I wanted to avoid was slavishly replicating what people might understand as distinctive kind of Southern or African American dishes. You know, I've seen some people who are interested in kind of like reinterpreting African American cuisine or Southern cuisine, and they'll simply remove the animal product and replace it with tofu or tempeh. And I certainly wanted to... There are some superstars in there, you know, that I wanted to just like reinvent pretty much, you know, word for word. But more importantly, I wanted to take these staples from Africa, from the Caribbean, Native American, European cooking techniques, distinctive dishes, and kind of rework, remix, rewind, and create something new that's rooted in this cuisine that's familiar, but that's looking forward and modern and interesting. So, you know, that was one of those dishes where I was like, okay, black-eyed peas, prominent staple in African American cooking. How can I take it and make it interesting and fun and tasty?
Wow, that sounds great. I can't wait to look at this cookbook.
And back to the potatoes, we'll have your recipe for the cumin cayenne
How do you say that?
Cayenne.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. There's so many words you see on the spice jar, but you don't pronounce. Mashed potatoes with caramelized onions. Anything to add about that recipe?
It's the bomb. You know, that's all I can say about that one. No, it was really good. You know, mashed potatoes.
With no butter or sour cream.
No butter. Rich, creamy. Like you said, you know, tubers, leafy greens, these are nutrient-dense, really filling and inexpensive ingredients that we can use in these harsh economic times. My next book is actually based on kind of like I'm calling it a self-ethnography, in which for a year I'm turning my gaze inward and documenting how my fiance and I are eating from our home garden, from our CSA, and from our farmer's market, and making meals that are not only sustainable and local and seasonal, but inexpensive. So I've been making a lot of soups, a lot of dishes using leafy greens and tubers. And, you know, in this book, I have that one. But one of my other favorites in the book is a mixed green and potato gratin. And we've been getting so many greens and so many sweet potatoes and yams and potatoes from our CSA. And so I've been, you know, making that dish a lot. So
great. So you've already got a book underway.
Oh, yeah, that's great. And if you want to get a copy of this book, we have one copy that we're giving away to the first caller who calls up at the KBOO front desk, 503-231-8032. First caller gets a copy of that book. Laurie, what, you want to tell us what it is?
It's The Vegan Soul Kitchen. Fresh, healthy, and creative African-American cuisine, written by Bryant Terry, who's sitting right here with us, and it comes with music and reading selections. You really don't want to miss out on this.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us on the KBOO Food Show on 90.7 FM in Portland, and we're going to take a little bit of a music break.
Oh, yeah. You like potatoes?
You like potatoes.
You like tomatoes.
And you like tomatoes.
Potatoes.
Potatoes.
Tomatoes.
Tomatoes.
Let's go.
Sounds like Barbara King's song.
We were smart. And oh, if we ever part, then that might break my heart. Oh,
Well, that was Let's Call the Whole Thing Off. You're listening to the KBOO Food Show on 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Laura McCandless.
And we usually have Marlies Franklin, but she's out with a sick kid. And we're going to go now to a segment I produced on potato farmer Lyle Stanley. He also grows lots of other things. He runs G Creek Farm in Ridgefield, Washington. And he talked to me about all his different potato varieties, and then I chatted with some folks about what they do with potatoes. Just a minute. Looks like we're having a little bit of
butterballs.
There we go.
For baking and frying and mashing, and kind of all around good potatoes. Got a nice, beautiful yellow flesh to it.
Yeah, they are really yellow. How do they get so yellow? Is that just the breed?
That's just the breed. They're related to the yellowfin, and the other one they're related to is this one, which is called Yukon Gold. They're in the Irish type of family. That is, it's a round type potatoes, and they are good for, you know, a lot of different things.
Are these redder ones are the russets, no?
No, this is not a russet. This is called red thumb, or a type of fingerling potato. Fingerlings tend to be more of the primitive style. And potatoes come from the high Andes. That's where they're originally from, way high up. And they tend to be a little more firm, so they're good for different kinds of things, like stews, where you don't want them to fall apart. And these Russian bananas.
I've never heard of that. A Russian banana fingerling?
Yeah, Russian banana fingerlings. You know, Russian Jews during Passover, there's a part of the ceremony called karpas, which is the part where you use like spring green, Well, because the Russians are so high up, by the time Passover is, it's not spring there yet, right? So they actually take a piece of potato for their karpas instead of parsley, which is traditional. This is a beautiful one. It's got some different colorings. This is the French red. See, each country does its own breeding. And breeding is a beautiful, long-term, multi-generational activity that men and women do, and then they kind of pass the baton to the next generation. This is not GMO-style breeding. This is the old style where you select.
Hi, I wonder if you could talk to me. I'm with the KBOO Food Show, and we're doing a segment this month on potatoes.
I think they're great. I think they're really nutritious. They have a lot of different nutrients and minerals, and I'm going to use these as seed to grow for my school program. I teach horticulture, so I'm going to grow these as potatoes.
You're not going to eat those? You're going to put those in the bag?
Half of them. I'm going to eat half and then grow the rest. I work at Fort Vancouver High School, and I run the horticulture science program, where we have about half an acre of vegetables that we're going to grow and a greenhouse where we sell different plants.
If you're going to buy seed, you need to buy it from somebody who grows it high up, like we do. Because the fungus doesn't like the altitude for some reason. So you want to grow it high up, and you also want to get it from an organic farmer because we're not allowed to spray it with waxes or sealers or growth inhibitors. Each one of these is an eye, and you want to have two eyes on a 2-ounce piece. So this would probably be two pieces. You hearing this?
Yes, yes.
This would be about two pieces, and you let it dry out. And maybe you'll see one of these that have been dried out. And if you let it go in the open, it'll seal itself because it's alive. And it wants to preserve itself, so it'll seal itself off. It knows it's been cut. It's kind of consciousness, actually. Not a consciousness like you and I with a brain, but it knows it's been cut. It seals itself off to preserve itself. $6.
So what are you doing with your potatoes? Are you going to plant them?
Oh, I do occasionally plant some, yes.
Do you eat others?
But I eat most of them, yes. I love potatoes.
Okay, what do you do with them? How do you eat them?
Oh, generally steam them and just butter, salt, and pepper. I'm definitely just for potatoes.
Do you keep your skins on?
Absolutely.
$1.70. They have a lot of flavor, too.
Yeah. Even in my potato salad.
We're just making a salmon salad with
kind of like a Nice slaw salad.
Potatoes.
Yeah.
Instead of tuna, using salmon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you going to use the anchovies?
No, I don't think so, actually. I love anchovies, but...
That's always my kicker question on the Nice slaw salad. There are the anchovy negative people and the ones that I like them too.
We're anchovy positive, but it might be a little mustard dressing.
But I think if you get good potatoes at the market, I mean, you don't really need to do much with them.
One of the crops that gets me through the wintertime. We try to have income through the year so that we can pay people year-round who work for us,
okay,
work with us. Our friends, you know, our friends who help us grow the food for the people.
Okay.
That's our goal, is to feed our community locally.
That was Lyle Stanley of G Creek Farm speaking to me, Miriam Widman, at the Hillsdale Farmers Market. Lyle has a CSA. He's got shares available, and he's also at various farmers markets, including Hillsdale and Portland Farmers Market. He can be reached at G Creek Farm. That's GEECREEKFARM.com. And we thank Lyle for his contribution to the KBOO Food Show. Looks like we have a winner. Someone has called in from our previous segment to win the book by Brian Terry. And this is really exciting for us. He called in because he listened to KBOO online. He's in Toledo, Ohio. Congratulations to Joel Schitzlein. I'll do the German pronunciation. Not sure if that's the way it is. Great, Joel. We're glad that you listen online in Ohio to our show. Thank you so much for listening. And congratulations on winning this cookbook.
And just to remind you of the name of the book again, it's The Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine by Bryant Terry and published by DeCapo Press.
And just in case you don't know who we are or you've just tuned in, you're listening to the KBOO Food Show on 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. And Laura, tell us about our next segment.
All right. Well, our next segment is from Marlise Franklin, who is out. She interviewed an heirloom potato breeder extraordinaire, Tom Wagner. He mates potatoes with through Tater Mater seeds in Everett, Washington.
I'll give all my money, all I had spent. That's good. Lord, I've got a special place resting on my mind. Now I tipped up to my window, wished I had a gun. My vine was wrapped around him. Sure was going some. You know he was digging my potatoes. Sapping on my vine. Lord, I've got a special place. Resting on my mind. Play it, boy. Ticket, ride Highway 61. Why forever I find them, as why trouble be gone. You know she's digging my potatoes, tap it on my vine.
Bumper home. What is the Irish lumper? Well, you're going to have to wait a little bit to find that out. He has thousands of varieties of potatoes and tomatoes dancing and sprouting around in his head. He has been hybridizing and mating potato and tomato varieties for generations. Okay? It's amazing. His name is Tom Wagner, and he's with me today. I'm meeting him up here in Vancouver before a workshop. And Tom, tell us about the Irish lumper. Let's start off with that.
Well, the Irish lumper is just one of those potatoes that was created back in the early 1800s over in England, and they brought it over to Ireland. And because it was such a user-friendly potato, I mean, it was perfect for organic. It could grow on poor soil. Soil that was grown on potatoes year after year, a white potato, a low solids, which was the good thing about it.
What does that mean? Low solid?
Low solid, low gravity, low starch.
Okay.
So you could eat more of them without gaining weight. And the Irish worker, my guy, sometimes only had but a small little plot of ground after he worked for the landlord, usually an Englishman. So the lumpers was something he could rely on readily for food. So they'd always have a big pot of lumpers boiling in water, and then when they were done, they had them in a wire basket above the boiling water to keep them hot so they could come in any time of day and eat potatoes. The average Irish person ate about 5 pounds, but a working Irishman would eat up to 14 pounds per day, if nothing else.
Now, you come from this heritage of Irish potato eaters and farmers.
Well, let me just explain. My granddad was born on an island called the Isle of Man, right in the middle of the Irish Sea. And before he came here, he told me that he grew the up-to-date variety, which was just produced a few years before in 1894. But coming to this country in 1907, he didn't have a chance to bring the up-to-date with him. His mom told him he'd find some other potatoes here. But anyway, my grandfather grew the up-to-date variety, which I'm growing. I'm getting brand new clean seed stock of that up-to-date. And my grandfather grew the lumpers on the Isle of Man. In fact, would trade potatoes for other things. He was a brickmaker and farmer. And sometimes he would trade for lumpers, you know, for bricks, you know.
So he would trade for bricks. So lumps for bricks.
And it's funny about lumpers, you know, you think of a lump of coal or you take your lumps. I mean, it was an apt name, but the lumpers today are considered, you know, it's like a death threat to talk about lumper, because so many Irish, over a million people died from not having enough food. And when the blight came through, it didn't affect the lumper fully, but it affected the tubers, and they rotted and storied. So they ended up not having enough to eat, and they had to immigrate United States, Canada, Australia, whatever. And, I mean, it affected Europe, the mainland of Europe. I know my great-great-grandfather had some failures in Luxembourg in the early 1850s. So by 1854, you know, I mean, they were just leaving the country in droves. So whether it's Luxembourg or Isle of Man, they depended on potatoes.
Mm-hmm. So are some of the current varieties that we eat ancestors of the lumper potato? And are they called lumpers because they're lumpy?
Well, they are lumpy, and I don't think they really got the name lumper because of that shape, although it probably helped memorize the name. There's a whole history of the word lumper, you know, it's taken from many sources of the English language. But when you grow lumpers, if you don't have good soil, it will have protruding eyes, which makes it look lumpy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I wish I had a potato right here in front of you, but I have it out in my car, you know, showing other growers.
So it's not something that we, if we look at a potato, that we would be familiar with.
We don't have, as far as I know, any descendants from the lumper in our breeding project. In fact, very few potatoes have identified pedigree back to some of these old varieties. We've kind of like given up on the Scandinavian varieties, the varieties from Iceland that were from the 1700s. We're not using those in today's breeding operations. They're mostly modern varieties, which might go back to the up-to-date series, the late 1800s, or United States varieties from the time of Burbank and the early Rose.
It almost sounds like you're talking about art, you know, the postmodern, the Renaissance, you know, the different phases. So the modern up-to-date is the 1840s, and then that's kind of to present. Is that right?
Well, the up-to-date variety was being grown because it was replacement to other varieties they thought were susceptible to blight. So the up-to-date across between the old Queen Victoria and the old Blue Dawn. So I know the pedigree on it. But nobody used the lumper directly in breeding work, but they used the Queen Victoria in the crosses from it with other varieties, so we do have some record of that. But one of the things I'm trying to do is get people to try more of the old-fashioned, really, truly heirloom varieties, and then try some of the varieties that I've bred up where I'm improving the flavor, fast cooking time, maybe 5 minutes cooking time rather than 20 minutes, more of the beta-carotene, more of the anthocyanin, the super blues, the super red flesh variety, and varieties that have good blight resistance. In fact, some of my favorite potatoes have the lumpers in their background, but in order to overcome the blight problem, I bred in varieties from Mexico that had super blight resistant, Tolocan, for example. Great potato, and it gives it a yellow flesh, has more yield than the lumper. And then in order to get better flavor, I crossed it with my Tom Kagan, which is my grandfather, and man, I'm getting some really great flavor with the ability to yield and have blight resistance and be grown on soil without putting on tons of fertilizer. In fact, I'm going almost totally organic anymore simply because I think it's the way to go.
It sounds like you're talking about your children, and I love that. You told me on the phone that you have thousands of varieties in your head, and it's really lovely how, you know, you're integrating sounds like your children.
Well, I love incorporating things. When I hold up a potato or a single seed, I like to think of all of the travel that seed went through, all the different parents. For example, I sowed seed yesterday in which the parents go back to two different Scandinavian varieties, a variety from South America, Graciella, then also back to some varieties from Colorado that had high gravities, a couple of varieties from Idaho that had high solid for French frying and dehydration, also from Peru, of great late blight resistance, and then a variety that just released this past week out of the tri-state area, having 37% more protein, which I can't use for breeding work because I'm not an official plant breeder. I'm just an old-fashioned Burbank breeder. But I have that just-released variety, russet, that has this extra protein. I have that crossed in where now I have great-great-grandchildren of it. For them to have this kind of generation turnover, it would be 50 years in the future. So what I'm trying to do is put all of this stuff into a single potato with all this tremendous pedigreed information flavors. So now I have potatoes that have bright yellow flesh, great flavor, cooked fats, are blight resistant, has more protein. I know it does because it tastes good, and I go to toward tasting potatoes to the point where I just love potatoes, and I keep growing more of those that taste good.
Right. Well, that's what we want. We want to be able to taste the potato, and
exactly.
We want it to be good. We're speaking.
That was heirloom potato breeder Tom Wagner of Tater Mater Seeds in Everett, Washington, speaking to our colleague Marlise Franklin. You're listening to the KBOO Food Show. The rest of that interview will be available up on the website pretty soon. That's Marlise speaking with potato breeder Tom Wagner. Laura, we're going to go to a music break. Why don't you tell us what we're going to be listening to?
We are going to listen to an edited version of Move by Q-Tip, the rapper from A Tribe Called Quest, which Brian Terry recommends cooking your cumin cayenne mashed potatoes to.
Come on, let's move. Get down, ride with me, come on. Come on, let's shuffle. Your dubious style may rock for right now, but in the long run, you really lost one. Jamaica, Queens, man, land of the Charleston. It's never easy, but it's not easy. Go through the checkpoints, first slip to pole nine. I got a bad bird, nicknamed the sunshine. My streets are so kind, sweet nothing's at nighttime. This is the right tune, she hits it right.
Can you imagine making mashed potatoes to that tune? That was pretty good. That was
Move
by Q-Tip. And that was recommended by our author who was on, the author of Vegan Soul Kitchen, Brian Terry, who talked to us earlier. You're listening to the KBOO Food Show. And now up, we have another track from our colleague Marlise. We're going to move on to our community segment with a visit to Roosevelt High School. Marlise visited the students of the Community Transitions Program, which helps those with moderate learning disabilities transition into adulthood. They have planted a garden, and they have big plans for it.
Okay, so this is the vision here. This is the dream. The baby garden. So, Liz, you were saying, I heard that you put a lot of work into the design of the garden. Tell us about what's going on here.
The design is the shape of a sun, and we really came up with the idea because we thought that it'd be a good idea so we can have a little more room in the pots that we were going to put the plants in. And we just thought it would be a neat idea to have it in the shape of a sun.
I see you have walkways here in the middle, too. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why is this garden so important to you?
It's important to me because I've wanted to work in this garden ever since I was a freshman, and now I finally get the chance to.
So you've always seen it as sort of a plot of land that has potential.
Yes.
And now you get to realize that potential.
Yes.
That's awesome.
What's your name?
I'm Sam.
Sam? What do you want to see from this garden?
I want to see big plants that we can use for cooking, for our waffle cart next year, and a way for us to get food cheaper. Mm-hmm. It'll save us a lot of money in the next couple years.
So you're thinking maybe putting these things into the waffle cart and selling them as produce or as actual, like, menu items?
Like, in the ingredients for or certain foods that we'll make in the waffle cart.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, this is another Elizabeth, and I heard that you've also been working really hard on the garden.
Yes.
And what is your specific dream that you look for?
Pumpkins over there.
Pumpkins?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Any particular kind of pumpkins? The big jack-o'-lantern?
Yeah, for the Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Those need a lot of space to grow, kind of. They have those big leaves.
Yeah, we're going to put them over there somewhere.
Uh-huh. What else are you looking forward to?
Eating them.
Eating the pumpkins. Excellent. So, do you like pumpkin pie?
Not really. I'm just a fan of pumpkins.
Mm-hmm. You carve them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other fruits or vegetables that you'd like to see?
Pears and grapes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you like getting your hands dirty?
Yeah, a little bit.
Do you wish someone else could get the hands dirty and you could just come by and pick it all up?
Yeah.
I do. Sometimes this is the hardest work, right?
Yeah.
In here, it's cold, it's rainy, it's windy.
Yep.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
My birthday's this Saturday. All right. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Matt, is that your name, Matt?
Yes.
So, it's your turn.
Basically, what we've been doing is we've been digging up the grass and in certain areas, so then we can start planting and putting in, like, flowers, vegetables, like, as you can see. We have a plan to put maybe corn or tomatoes right there, and maybe in the center we have flowers, as people have said.
The flowers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It looks like this ground is not, it looks very hard and sort of it would be difficult to dig.
Yeah, it is, but...
You're a big guy.
Yeah, I'm a big guy, and it may be hard for some people, but not for me.
So you like getting out here and be physical and really working with the land?
Yes.
Have you ever done this kind of work before?
Yes, I have. I've done, like, maybe... I'd go out and mow lawns, or I'd dig up and plant flowers, or, you know, grow fruit. I'm used to it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you're a good asset to the garden, then.
Thank you.
For sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Ow. Can I say something else?
You want to say something else, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I like WWE.
What is WWE?
Wrestling.
Oh!
I like John Cena and Jeff Hardy. They're my favorite WWE superstars.
I love wrestling too, but I don't have a TV anymore, darn it.
They're the cute ones.
They're the cute ones. That's the good ones to watch. Anyone else here? Would you like to? You haven't had a moment to speak. How about you? What's your name again? Please tell me.
My name is Daniel Penn.
Daniel Penn. So Daniel Penn, do you like this idea of the garden?
Yeah, it's a pretty good idea. New challenges, new awakenings, you know. We start our own garden, produce our own produce. Vegetables, I guess it'll save us money in the long run. Maybe even build up for another fun end-of-year trip, you know?
So you mean if you sell the produce that you could make some money off of that and...
possibly go on another end-of-year trip.
Where do you want to go?
Well, the class hasn't decided. Last year when we went to Seaside, had a blast. It was fun, you know?
Yeah.
I'd like to see that happen again this year.
Well, it looks like you have some work to do.
Yes, we
do. To get there.
It's a stepping stone, I say.
That's right.
Another obstacle.
You have some stepping stones already in the garden.
Beautiful. We already trampled them. Just another climb up the ladder.
Thank you.
No problem.
I'm speaking with the teachers here, Donna and Allison. You're putting the community transitions program together. And Donna, can you tell us what your program is?
It's a community transition program for students with modified diplomas, so they have disabilities. Most of the students in this program have learning disabilities, and they're 18 to 21 years of age, and we just assist them to transition to adulthood, whether that means community college, a job, or independent living skills.
So you're actually not a part of the Roosevelt High School?
No. We're just housed at Roosevelt. Yeah.
So it's not a PPS program?
It is a PPS program, because anyone with a disability who is on an individual education program, they get to have services until they're 21 years of age.
Okay.
So
the idea of the garden, Allison, do you want to talk about how you came up with that idea?
Yeah, the idea of the garden is to give literal hands-on experience for our students. So our students are able to come out, they kind of start from the ground up. So we're planting, we're digging. Our vision is eventually for us to be able to sell the produce to the community, whether at a farmer's market or some other route, so that our students are not only gaining gardening skills, so they could potentially have their own garden someday, but also interacting with the community and learning, you know, skills as far as selling, using cash registers, selling money. And we hope that while they're doing this, they're learning about the importance of eating fresh produce, the importance of eating locally, and where they can then educate other people in the community about that sort of information.
So part of the program is to integrate also the produce that you grow. One of the students mentioned the produce that you grow will be integrated into a cooking class.
Yeah, a lot of our students in their individualized education plans focus on cooking skills. It's something that we feel strongly when they're out in the community, when they're living in their own apartments, that they can cook for themselves. And I think it's really important to us that we help show them how you can cook with whole foods and cook with a tomato and how much you can make with a tomato and not just go to the store and buy a jar of it. So I think really incorporating fresh produce in the cooking class is going to be a key component.
Mm-hmm. Does it seem like something that's completely new to them as far as like the fresh produce idea?
Yeah, to many of the students it is. They have no idea where produce comes from, and they're pretty much existing on fast food diets. But last year, when we had the Pier Park Community Garden, we did a big harvest this fall, and students that had never seen these plants before, didn't know the names of them, started making stir fries. And at first they were making fun of all the food and said, oh, I'm not going to try this. They all ate all the produce that we brought in. So that was amazing to see. And it gave us hope that we could see a shift in nutrition, which connects to health care and everything else that makes a community healthy and viable.
Is there something that the community can give to the kids and to your program that will really support you and the people who work here?
I think people coming out. It's amazing to me the response that the students give to other people coming in from the community, and that experience that they have when they're meeting other people. That's the most powerful way to contribute to our program. I think just coming on out and digging with students, bringing some knowledge to them. You know, they're sick of listening to their teachers all the time. So having people come out that it's amazing the response we get from students when there's other people in the community involved.
And also oftentimes, I mean, it's unfortunately a marginalized population of people who don't really get that sort of interaction with others.
And that's the point of our program, is to connect our students with people in the community so that they can take off with that. And the more people we have coming out to our garden space and to other projects that we have in the works, the more students get to know people in the community, the more the community recognizes them and their skills and perhaps will hire them in the future, you know. These are the seeds that we're planting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Donna and Allison, for joining us today. And definitely we'll keep an eye out for your produce and anytime you want to engage the listeners and put your name out there and let us know how things are going.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Marlies Franklin, our co-host, speaking with students and teachers of the Community Transition Program, and we'll be keeping an eye on their progress.
Finally, we will hear a brief announcement about the 4th National Farm to Cafeteria Conference, which is taking place in Portland this weekend. It's sponsored by the Community Food Security Coalition, which recently relocated to Portland from Los Angeles. And the conference will feature book talks with food security experts such as Joel Berg. He's the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and the author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. And here is Andy Fisher, the president of the Community Food Security Coalition, telling you more about this weekend's conference.
And it's taking place at the DoubleTree Hotel on Thursday, March 19th to 21st. And it's going to be a gathering of more than 600 people from around the country who are interested and who are working in their communities on improving school meals, primarily through making connections with local farmers and local food processors. So it's the premier networking and educational event in the country for folks who are interested in how to make school meals healthier and how to get more money into the pockets of local farmers. So we encourage you to come. There's plenty of space still available. You can check out more information on the conference at www.farmtocafeteriaconference.com. And our phone number is 503 954-2970.
And that's pretty much it for this month's segment of the KBOO Food Show. We'll be back next month in April, the third Wednesday of the month from 11 to 12. That's our new time slot. And we'll be talking next month about how eating food now in this recession is maybe comparable to past times. We'll be having guests and some taped programs, people who lived through the Depression in the 20s and 30s, and also through food rationing in World War II. And do we have anything else coming up that we know of for next month already, Laura?
I believe that we will also be focusing some on meat, and if you're cutting back on meat during these tight economic times, and if you're trying to eat meat but in a sustainable, conscious way, you know, how do you navigate all the labels from grass-fed to organic? Maybe you're looking to more fringe meats like rabbit. We've got several rabbit producers in Portland. Maybe you're turning away from pork or mass-produced pork, which has been shown to be contaminated with the staph virus MRSA. So there's a lot of questions for ethical eaters when it comes to meat consumption.
Right, so that's what we have up for you next month, and we'll be going out. Once again, we'll let you hear Let's Call the Whole Thing Off from the great American musicians and singers Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. Eat safely.
Oh, you like potatoes?
And you like potatoes?
You like tomatoes?
And you like tomatoes?
Potatoes?
Potatoes?
Tomatoes?
Tomatoes?
Let's call the whole thing off.
Pajamas.
You got pajamas.
But we know we need each other.